So, welcome again to another edition, another episode, and another installment. I can keep going with these different, what are we doing here?
Cinnamon, maybe?
Cinnaminizing?
Yeah.
We're
Cinnamon.
cinnaminizing. So anyway, we got another episode here with a very special guest today. His name is Cameron. Cameron, thanks for being here again.
Glad to be here. And
Yeah.
I am indeed very special.
This is true. He was dropped as a kid on his head.
Got the special bus and everything.
That's true. Not really true.
No, it's not really true.
Okay, but it could be.
It's true in the sense of not being true.
Okay, good. Well, write that down. So, Cameron, we've had him on the call before, and he's been one of the most helpful and insightful guests we've had on here. And I want to talk a little about what he specializes in. If you have been a longtime member, you are familiar with Cameron. If you are new, then you probably have never heard of the guy. He has spoken on TED, if anyone's ever follows the TED Talks. It's like the cream of the crop as far as intelligent people speaking goes. People like Tony Robbins, Al Gore, other Richard Branson, other people like that. I'll speak up there, and Cameron was one of the guys that spoke up there as well. And he is a master of personality typing. And I do integrate a whole lot of personality typing into my material, specifically because different guys who have different personality types approach the idea of attracting women completely differently. So what I did last time, the first time I met him, I left and immediately started writing and created my entire hacking attraction curriculum based on the stuff I learned from Cameron. And it's one of the most forward-thinking programs in existence. If you've checked it out, then it reveals some stuff about yourself that you probably didn't know. And hopefully that is okay for you to learn. Hopefully you want to know it. But he's here again, and I really want to get into talking a little bit more about personality types. I'd like to dive in a little bit deeper. Last time we talked a lot about introvert, extrovert, and how
Right.
that kind of affects the way that you may approach women, not just walk up to women, but how you approach the concept of attracting women. And Brad is introverted. Cameron, you're introverted. I'm extroverted. And so it's a very, very, very big difference, especially if you're going out at nighttime. The chance to get overwhelmed as an extrovert is a lot lower, the opportunity at least, and for overwhelm for introverts typically.
Yeah. Introverts tend to focus more on their inner world than the outer world, and they actually tend to be a bit more sensitive to stimuli, so they get overstimulated and therefore overwhelmed relatively easily.
Does that mean that all introverts have a problem with premature ejaculation?
Yes, all of them.
All of them, every single one.
Except me, of course.
Yeah,
I don't know about Brad.
I don't know about Brad, but so that was what we talked about last time. But there's so much more about this that we didn't go into detail because it was just a really in-depth topic. Brad, I know that you have a lot of questions about this, and you've learned a lot about it too. It has been one of the most powerful typing systems, period, that I've ever seen, but one of those powerful techniques that I've used to not just fix my own relationships, my interactions, but also to cater what I'm saying to people that I'm talking to. And this is a really powerful concept. If you meet a girl and you know her personality type, you can literally cater what you say so that she feels comfortable and connected with you, but not anybody else, really, or very, very few other people. So you can just
It
change that. Go ahead.
also helps you understand where people are coming from.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, you're not going to think like, oh, this person's just shy and it doesn't like anybody here. You're going to think, okay, well, they just need some time to recharge. For me, it's been helpful just understanding other people.
Right. And I think that also, not blaming people for what we believe is like their faults or whatever. It's reframed a lot of that for me too, and I've been able to look at my interactions with not just women, but business and in personal interactions, just in general, friends and whatnot. And I stopped. I noticed that after I got this system in my mind, I understood a little bit more. I stopped blaming people for stuff. I started being more open and letting people kind of be themselves, and it allowed me to level up my ability to have social control because I wasn't able before this to sit back and relax as much. And now that I have these models that really are really powerful, that I'm able to sit back and relax a lot more and let other things happen. I have sort of like, it's sort of like before I had a lot of tools in my belt, but they weren't really sharp, you know, they weren't really honed and they weren't put together well. And I didn't know how to pull out a certain tool for a certain job. You know, I'd look at a job that I needed to get done. It was like, you know, I'd say, for example, I would, you know, using this analogy, I needed to build a wall, so to speak. Right. Well, now I know that I need to measure with a measuring tape. I need to cut wood with a saw. I need to hammer with a hammer and nails, you know, and I have to do this and I have to putty, right? I need all these tools and I know that ahead of time. So now I can look at somebody and I can go, all right, instead of just throwing shit at, you know, trying to figure it out, like taking a hammer out and trying to cut a board with a hammer and realizing that doesn't work and then trying a screwdriver, that doesn't work.
Well, maybe you're just not hitting it hard enough.
Yeah, exactly. Spin the hammer around. You know, or then finally trying a saw and that works. You know, now I know exactly what tool to use for each situation that I'm in, and it's because of the stuff that I learned from Cameron. So extremely valuable stuff, and I respect the guy a whole lot. So I hope you gain a lot from this. What I'd like to do, Brad, is dive in a lot deeper though, while you're here, and well, so while you're on the call with Cameron, I mean, because I know that you have a lot of curiosity around this as well. And you may come up with mm-hmm. some questions that I may not ask and I may not answer. So I'd really like to hear a little bit more about the different major functions, as you call them, Cameron.
Okay.
And Brad, I'd really like to hear you kind of wrap and ask any questions that you might have for Cameron as he does that. Does that sound like a cool thing to do?
Works for me.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, great. So Cameron, why don't you start out by explaining a little bit, you know, in layman's terms, a little bit about the functions, what they are, and then name, you know, what they are zoomed out, right? And then name each one, and then talk a little bit about what how that affects you, you know, and how to find out which one's your function.
Sure.
You know.
Okay. Well, this is this topic is complex and has a lot of depth because we're talking about people, and people are complex. So I'll stick to the overview because we don't have, you know, I actually teach a 6-month course on this stuff.
And we have time.
Yeah. Okay.
And we'll be starting that right
so,
now.
So just sit tight for the next 6 months and we'll cover it all. No, anyway. So basically, what the system that we work with most goes back to Carl Jung and some of the work he did, you know, roughly 100 years ago, not quite that long, but in that ballpark. And what he identified was 8 different what are called cognitive processes or cognitive functions. And they're basically little kind of mental mechanisms, little specific algorithms that operate inside all of our brains. There are 8 total. And 4 of them are different methods of understanding information, of taking in something new. And 4 of them are ways of evaluating information, ways to make decisions based on what you've taken in. And we all use all 8 of them. It's just kind of part of being human. But everyone has a strong preference for one of the 4 ways to take information in and one of the 4 ways to make decisions. So that preference for those 2 processes is what creates personality. This is the basis of Myers-Briggs. This is the basis of a lot of the other personality typing systems that you've seen out there. Chemistry.com uses a simplified version of this, dramatically simplified, by the way. They only have 4 types, whereas in this system there's actually 16. And you see it in lots and lots of places. This is kind of going back to the root, though. One of the main differences in looking at the cognitive functions versus a lot of the other kind of styles of dividing personality up is that this is about how your brain works inside. It's about what's happening inside your head. Other systems tend to focus on your behavior and what's happening outside, and that obviously is really useful as well, but this is the most powerful system that I've ever discovered for being able to understand yourself, understand other people, and understand how to reach them and make a connection.
Almost in a scary way. You know, and this is like really where I found that it's very helpful, is that if you know, if I knew that for some reason that if you liked, I don't know, let's say you like roller coasters, that there was a correlation that 90% of people who like roller coasters also lived on waterfront property.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. I said that was the case. Then, and you said, I love roller coasters. And I said, let me guess. You grew up on a beach or a lake and you used to love going swimming when you were a kid. And you made up a story about something swimming in the water and used to scare each other saying it was chasing you.
Right.
Right. And imagine the amount of instant like power.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good illustration. What happens is that you understand how pieces of information, characteristics about a person that seem like they're not at all related on the surface, you understand how they actually are connected in kind of a backdoor way. So you hear something like, yeah, I love roller coasters, and you instantly know all this other information about a person that they didn't tell you. And it comes across like mind reading. It really, really does.
Mm-hmm. And it can be just as powerful as that. Mind reading, by the way, is typically a combination of three things. One is illusion, right? So it's not even real at all. Just, it's not even close to being
real. Right, and we're talking about like mentalists and people that do mind reading in some sort of performance format.
Yeah, usually performance format. Like, so like if they're mind reading on stage, it's probably a plant, like some, you know, someone's been planted in the room, that kind of thing. And then there's another thing that they do, which is called cold reading.
Yep.
Which is really complicated, but extremely powerful generalizations that sound very, very, very specific, right? So that's another way. And then the final way is subliminal messaging. These are usually the three different ways that people kind of go at using mind reading. This is interesting because subliminal messaging... what we said before was cold reading.
Yep.
And then, I'm forgetting the first one right now for some reason.
Illusion.
Illusion.
Illusion. All three of those are actually fake, right?
In some way, yeah.
Subliminal messaging is like a sneaky, like you're instilling an idea instead of reading their mind, you're giving them the idea. Cold reading is generalization sounding really specific. And then illusion is obviously just a straight up lie. This, though, is true.
Yeah.
So it's not fake. Myers-Briggs typing and the functions that we're going to talk about today are ways to do this that are not sneaky. It's actually real what you're doing. And I've been searching my entire life for a system like this. When I met Cameron, my jaw was on the floor because as he was describing this stuff, he was on stage and I was watching him and I was just like, this is it. This is the missing piece that I hadn't seen in such a long time that I've never really found, because I test everything, as you guys know. I test everything. And if it isn't 100% accurate, 100% of the time, I don't believe it's true. I don't take it as fact. And Myers-Briggs typing is the only system that I've ever found in these functions we're going to talk about today. All the only systems I've ever seen that work 100% of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to be clear for everyone's sake, Myers-Briggs is very closely related, but not exactly the same thing. Myers-Briggs, again, has a lot of usefulness, but they do not at all focus on the cognitive processes. They should, because it's part of the system, but they kind of tend to ignore that. So if you hear something labeled Myers-Briggs, then you'll get some of this information, but only about maybe 20%.
Okay.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. I mean, the go ahead and explain, so that now that you have, I know, Brad, I was going to let you sort of take over here and ask some questions, but I do have a lot of questions here. And I want to kind of direct this a little bit. Go ahead and explain like the, what you believe is... zooming out for a second.
Yep.
And I know that you're not like immersed in the same world than I am as far as like the attraction space and the seduction space as much as I am, right? But zoom out for a second and look at interactions with women and talk a little bit about what you believe is the number one function to look out for in a woman that would mean that she is, let's say that she's interested in casual sex, or she is she's a more of a traditional woman, or, you know, different functions we might be looking for, and then different ways to tell what, you know, like different little triggers we can look for in women.
So if you're, okay. Let's talk about the casual sex one first, because that's the most fun. the most likely, actually, you know, we didn't talk about what the functions are. Should we cover that first?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a good idea. This? Yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay, so this is a real brief overview, but the four different ways to make decisions are, first of all, what we call effectiveness, and these are kind of methods of evaluation. So a certain percentage of the population likes to make their decisions based on whichever choice is the most effective at getting a specific job done, whatever accomplishes a task or whatever works best. Mm-hmm. This is fairly common for men, not as common for women, but it you know, there's a definitely sizable percentage of both populations that have this preference. Next is what we call accuracy, and this is Josh's strength. Accuracy is making decisions based on what makes sense and what is has internal logical consistency. So you see this a lot, especially in the sciences and things like that.
Psychology, right, which is going.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Psychology is definitely one of the processes you see a lot in psychology, definitely. So those are two different ways of kind of making decisions based on some form of logical process. The next two have more to do with emotional processing. The next one is called authenticity. This is making decisions based on what is authentic and true to who you are as a human being.
Brad.
What just from your core feels like the right thing to do. Yeah, and absolutely, this is Brad's preference. I'm an effectiveness person, by the way, just for full disclosure.
That seems very authentic to me.
That was a lie, Brad.
Now, this is interesting because the fourth decision-making preference is overwhelmingly represented in the female population. This is what we call harmony, and a ridiculous percentage, something like 40% of the female population has harmony as their preference. Whenever you hear a stereotype about, like, you know, this is how women are, in almost every single case, what they're actually talking about is not the gender as a whole, but this one specific decision-making process. Harmony is making decisions based on their social consequence, making decisions based on how the emotional state of other people will be impacted. How their relationship will be impacted, what will raise or lower your reputation, things like that.
Now, I'd like to add in here that it's not always to everyone else's benefit that they're making decisions. I mean, it's often can often be something like, this is going to make them really jealous and therefore I'm going to do it, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. With all of these preferences, they're neither good nor bad. They're just kind of a different way of doing things. A person can use each of these preferences in a mature, sophisticated way or an immature, kind of destructive
fun
way.
Oh.
And
hilariously fun way.
Yeah, hilariously fun. So, yeah, understanding the social consequence of decisions can easily lead a person to go, okay, well, if I do this, it'll make him jealous and that will give me the advantage.
Right, right. And this is actually one of the topics that we talk about a lot, which is pre-selection. There's a concept sort of playing off pre-selection called jealousy plot lines. And this is one of the most effective ways to get women to chase you is to attract another woman nearby, right? Because now they're beginning to see this other person become attracted
absolutely.
To you, and they become influenced socially in a really major way by the things that they see around them, especially in a social environment in this case, right?
Yeah. Now, again, if you're making all your decisions, or at least the majority of them, based on their social consequence, then things like social proof are going to be extremely important to you. If, you know, maybe you like a guy, but all of your friends don't like him, then that's going to be pretty influential.
Wow. All
right. We're going to stop there for a second and just stare at each other. Gaze longingly.
Okay, so that's the four different ways to make decisions. Now, everyone has a preference for one of those four. So one of those four should have kind of resonated with you more than the other three. The other set is how people take information in. So there's four different styles of this as well. And there actually is not a gender bias in this set. So this is pretty much evenly distributed among men and women. So the first way to take information in is what we call memory. This is the largest percentage of the population, both male and female. Again, it's somewhere in the 40 or 45% range. And this is understanding new information in terms of what's already happened. So when you hear something new, you kind of compare it to what you already have seen, what you've already heard, and you go, how is this similar? How is this different? And people that have this as a strength want to create continuity with the past. They tend to have a stabilizing kind of influence on society, and they tend to be very traditional. Next is what we call sensation, and this is extremely focused on the here and now. It's all about the present moment. What is the strongest sensory stimulus that I'm getting right now? What's in my immediate environment in this present moment?
How does that kind of show itself in ways like an example of that maybe?
Okay, well, this is something that you see a lot in athletes. Anyone that uses their senses a lot in their job is generally going to have a preference for this process. They are very aware of their body. They tend to be fantastic at reading body language just naturally because they're so aware of what something means if they're doing it physically. They can easily pick that up in other people. They tend to be easily bored if there isn't a lot of sensory stimulation around. They tend to have to kind of stay in motion. They don't like to stay still. They are generally pretty active. And they're also pretty fun. They're, again, focused on what's happening here and now. And they like to seek thrills, excitement, and whatever is very stimulating.
Okay, cool.
So that's a lower percentage of the population, but still pretty significant. Next is a process that we call exploration. The previous two processes kind of focus on what information your senses tell you. Exploration doesn't focus on that directly. It instead focuses on patterns. What patterns can be observed emerging from what's happening here and now. This is, again, Josh and Brad actually both have a preference for exploration.
That's Brad's? Mm.
Yep.
I didn't know that. Wait, maybe I did know that. Brad, did you know that?
I guessed that.
I guessed honestly. It just now. When Cameron said that it was me, I guessed it.
Well, whenever we talked about, when you talked about being a patterns person, I sort of aligned it with intuitive on the Myers-Briggs scale. So, Cameron, maybe you could...
Sure, yeah.
Demystify why I got that.
Well, your intuition was correct. The previous two, sensation and memory, are two different styles of sensing. So everyone that has a preference for either sensation or memory is a sensor in the Myers-Briggs system. Exploration and the fourth process that we haven't talked about yet called perspectives, those are two different styles of intuitive understanding. So everyone that has a preference for either of those is intuitive in the Myers-Briggs system. So exploration people tend to have an advantage in the dating world because they pick up social patterns quicker than most other people do.
What? Yeah. Oh, wait. No, sorry. Shocker, I'm supposed to be excited about that.
The last system process is what we call perspectives, and this is pattern recognition as well, but it's focused more on the inner world as opposed to the outer world. And it is kind of more focused on what hasn't happened yet. It's more future-oriented. This is the rarest of actually all eight processes to have as a strength.
This is Kelsey all day long. It's my girlfriend.
This is Kelsey, and this is also me. It's for Kelsey and I, it's both our strongest preference.
Mm-hmm. How do you get anything done?
It's difficult to accomplish much. Anyway, so one of the strengths that perspectives people have is they're able to, for starters, they're a little disconnected. They're kind of have a lot of difficulty being here in the present moment. But that disconnection allows them to not really be completely attached to their own viewpoint, and so they can see things from other people's viewpoints relatively easily. So they can kind of get inside other people's heads really, really well. So that's the four. Now, the question was, what do you look for in pre-selection?
Right? Well, I think the question was, the first one was, which one do you look for in, if you're talking to a woman, let's say, for example, that, you know, which one of these functions would be forward for someone who would be more likely to sleep with you quickly versus someone who would take their time? And how should you approach, like, ramping up escalation and attraction with certain types? Like, if there's a certain girl and we get a feeling about something, we can kind of navigate her personality in our heads. How can we tell how we should change our approach to best fit her desires?
So the two processes that are going to be most likely to be open to casual sex or something like that are going to be people that favor exploration or sensation.
Right. Sensation, it sounds like it could be more of like a, it could easily be a mistake for them.
Actually, sensation people are probably the most open
here. Oh, really?
Yeah, like people, porn actors are almost always sensation people. Almost always.
Okay.
Just as kind of a reference point.
Write that down.
Yeah. and it kind of makes sense. They're focused on sensory stimulation. It's athleticism, really, in a way. So... I mean, seriously.
Let's just go ahead and say that on the record, Cameron said porn stars are athletes officially. so, you know.
It's a physical performance. I mean, what else would you classify it as?
I don't consider thespians to be athletes.
But like the Cirque du Soleil performers?
That's not really a thespian, though, is it?
No, it's not.
See?
But that's closer to what I'm talking about. Anyway, that's a tangent. Anyway.
Anyway, back to porn.
Back to porn, right. So... what you're going to observe is an ability to kind of shift gears really quickly. Sensation and exploration people both have this. They're not going to come into almost anything with a preset plan. They're going to be kind of improvising as they go. So they tend to, again, kind of be the life of the party. They tend to have a lot of people around them and tend to be kind of open to possibilities. They tend to have a more playful demeanor. And they'll kind of banter with you just as a default.
Which one is this?
This is exploration and sensation. They'll both do that.
Okay.
Probably the least likely to do that would be memory people. For them, if they get into a situation like that, since, again, they tend to be so traditionally oriented, they would usually only sleep with you like on the first date or something like that. If they are under an inordinate amount of stress, and this is kind of like out of character for them, and they probably would regret it later.
Okay, good. Good, they need to.
Yeah. So I mentioned that everyone's going to have a preference for two of them. Probably the most likely would be a combination of sensation and accuracy.
Okay.
Sensation and accuracy people are going to, they're just not traditional. They're focus on the here and now, and they're not real concerned with a lot of kind of emotional
or social constructs, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. They're aware of it. They just don't really care.
Right. So they're kind of in their own social reality.
Right.
At times.
Example of this type would be Madonna and probably Angelina Jolie as well. I think they're both sensation accuracy people.
Okay. Two women that no one's ever wanted to sleep with. So
right, exactly.
That's probably pretty good.
Let's see, where are we?
Well, let me ask a couple questions about this at least.
Sure.
So how do you tell if a girl is, you know, accuracy and sensation focused? Those are her two functions.
Well, she's not going to project a lot of emotion in her interaction at all. She's going to have kind of a little bit of a cold exterior, not necessarily in a harsh way, but just... you're not getting a lot of emotion.
So basically she's Eastern European.
Yeah, Eastern European. she'll be very improvisational. One of the big tricks with this type of person is that they have an enormous respect for boldness and just kind of guts. So if you come across as timid or unsure of yourself, then they're going to have pretty much no interest in you immediately.
Right. This is being able to spot this from a distance can be very helpful.
It can.
I'm sure it's difficult to spot from a distance, though.
It is, and that's one of the challenges of the system. It explains a lot, but it's more about what's happening on the inside. So you kind of have to be able to at least interact with the person a little bit to get a solid read.
Okay. So what are some things that we can see at a distance? I mean, what's the personality type of someone who's got sensation and accuracy? Are there two?
What's that?
Aren't there two different personality types?
Oh, yeah.
Myers-Briggs-wise.
In Myers-Briggs terminology, this is the ESTP type, and to a lesser degree, the ISTP type.
So ESTP, which is extroverted, sensing, thinker, perceiver.
Correct.
Is, you can tell an extrovert by the pattern speech. You kind of went over that last time in your call with us.
Right.
You can usually tell. You can always, right?
Exactly. You can usually tell. Extroverts have more open tonality in their voices. Introverts tend to sound like they're holding something back. If you compare Josh's tonality with mine, you can kind of hear the difference.
You trained a lot to talk, though, as well.
Yeah, that's true.
But it does show that you've trained. You know what I mean? Like, you don't... there are several introverts that I do know and that I've seen in my life, you know, it's over time, that if I were to talk to them like this, they would actually sit there and think for a while before everything that they said, you know?
Yep. Introverts tend to think before they talk. So there'll be pauses. Just in general, they kind of don't share as much of what's going on. Their body language is more kind of subdued. Movements are more conservative. They're just more focused on what's happening in their inner world and less on what's happening in the outer world.
Okay. And then sensor, being a sensor, explain that for a second.
Sensor is...
Which is the S part, by the way, ESTP.
Right. That's focused on their sensory environment, what their senses are telling them. They're more concrete as opposed to abstract. This is one that is really difficult to tell just by observation.
But if you're going to be going statistically speaking on this, 3 out of every 4 girls you meet are probably going to be like this.
Absolutely. So they're going to have a sensory preference. Not necessarily the specific type, but this preference.
Right. They're going to be a sensor. So that means that you're pretty good just guessing that that's the case, right?
Absolutely. And in this case, I mentioned, so exploration people are also kind of falling in this category. So that would be the intuitive group, ENTPs.
Which is me.
It's just Josh, and to a lesser degree, INTPs.
Yeah, I was less excited about sex when I was single and more excited about social power.
Right.
I mean, it was more exciting for me to walk into a room full of people who don't know me and by the end of the evening have everybody trying to, like, fight for my attention. You know, that was more exciting to me than anything else. Like, it was just pushing the envelope for me that was exciting, which is why I got so good.
Right,
doing this because I wasn't satisfied with sensation. I wasn't satisfied with
things feeling good. Didn't have a particular outcome in mind. It was more the process that was.
I learned to be okay with that, though. By the way, I thought that was wrong for a long time, which is why when I finally accepted it about myself, I got really good really fast. You know, but knowing this can make can take you from 0 to 60 like that.
Absolutely.
So we have extroverted. So she's extroverts, I found, tend to talk a lot more with their hands, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Their body language is going to be more expressive and louder, for lack of a better term.
Right. And then also, they tend to flow a lot faster.
Yeah, the ESTPs and ISTPs are going to have kind of fluid body language as well. They're really physically aware, so they're... tend to have kind of a smoothness about what they do.
Okay, then we got the sensor part. Just guess that she's a sensor because that's 75% of the population roughly.
I have a question.
Is that way? Sure.
That's relevant to that. Mm-hmm. Cameron, does it seem that sensors and intuitives stick to their group?
Usually. And
with their friends and social circle?
Oh, actually, can you clarify what you mean by stick with their group?
Well, I mean, our intuitives typically surrounding themselves with intuitives and our sensors typically surrounding themselves with sensors.
Yeah, ideally. Okay. This is a really big split in kind of like worldview. So intuitives tend, since there's so much the lower part of the population, so relatively speaking, so much rarer. A lot of them just kind of feel like there's something wrong with them, and because they know that on some level they're not like most people. So if they are lucky enough to find other intuitives, then some sort of light bulb goes off and like, oh, finally someone that I can relate to and who kind of gets me. And they'll tend to kind of latch on to those few people in their lives really strongly.
So they have, basically that means that they have very few, very close friends.
Something like that, usually. Yeah, exactly.
I just say this because when somebody is like sort of evaluating their own experience, they might look around and go, I don't know, I don't really feel like any of the people that I know are really like sensors, and that may be true. I know I'm pretty sure, I mean, we could talk about this later, but I'm pretty sure I've surrounded myself with intuitives most of my life, and I always sort of felt like the rest of the people had something different that my friends and I didn't.
Right.
And it seems like from the friends that I have that are sensors, I think that they typically surround themselves with sensors as well, and there aren't often intuitives in their groups. So I was just curious as to know if that's, if you've seen that.
Absolutely. And what I was getting at is kind of the only exception to that is intuitives who don't know what they are. They don't know that their way of seeing the world is perfectly valid, and they just kind of feel like there's something wrong with them. Okay. If that's the case, then they do what we call blending, and they just try to fake it. They try to act like a sensor. So
it doesn't work very well.
It doesn't work very well. They're miserable, and they're not really bringing their best to the world. So it's not something I'd recommend.
I can usually tell that, too, because when I talk to them, I can see them light up because I'm an intuitive.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they get really excited for a minute, but they usually get scared. I mean, it's like a scary thing to think that way.
They've spent their entire life believing that there's something wrong with that way of looking at things. So if you're kind of turning that on, then it's very likely that they're kind of going to get scared because they've associated that with something they're not supposed to be doing.
Right. Brad, did you feel like you were this way?
Which way exactly?
Like, whenever I met you, besides that you knew who I was already and it was kind of intimidating already, did you kind of feel like a little bit scared that, that maybe you just, it just seemed like you belonged here, but you didn't really?
Yeah. Are you asking because you...
No, I'm just wondering what you think about that. I got that sense, but I never asked you that, you know, so kind of curious.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that seems to happen a lot, though, you know. And
yeah.
So that's the intuitive part. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on that, so...
Well, I'm glad you brought it up. I don't want to spend too much time on it either, but it's something that I think is critically important for intuitive people to kind of understand that there's not really something wrong with them, that their way of looking at things is fine and actually really needed in the world, and for them to find each other. So my partner and I have an entire program, which actually you were a guest speaker in, called the Intuitive Awakening, and it's just for that. It's to help kind of intuitive people understand how to use the tools that they've got in their head. I'm glad you brought it up.
So let's go on to the next one real quick. So we're looking for ESTPs here, really. That's what we're looking for. And I just want to clearly define what this person is going to be looking like individually, in individual pieces in the Myers-Briggs, and then kind of look at them as a whole. Like,
right.
What are some of their activities? What are they doing? How are they moving? How can we look across the room and go, this person's probably an ESTP or an ENTP, right?
Yeah. And ESFPs are also going to be pretty... pretty good in any of the perceivers, really. They're gonna be more open to this, but yeah, like if we're talking about the 80-20, like what's the highest likelihood? We're looking at ESTPs, ENTPs, and
ISTPs.
ISTPs and yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the thinker part.
Yeah, so thinker is basically preference for logic over emotion. And that's not a value judgment when I say that. Both are really important, but thinkers aren't going to bring a lot of emotionality to pretty much any interaction. They're going to have what a lot of people describe as kind of a cold interaction style. They prefer to kind of get to the point as opposed to engage in a lot of banter designed to put people at ease.
This is really hard for me. Because yeah. I'm a thinker, and whenever I went into an environment like a club or something like that, people needed a lot of coercing.
Yeah.
And so whenever I started talking, I was trying to get to the point, which, of course, the point is get serious with me and have a deep conversation. And if you do that and you skip the attraction phase and you skip the banter phase, all of a sudden you're in the friend zone. You are you're asking serious questions too early. You know, you're jumping into rapport too fast, and it kills all the attraction.
Right. Now, one thing to keep in mind is that ESTPs actually are not super interested in going real deep, hardly ever. So if you do that like a tiny bit, you'll have their attention. But if you go more than like 5 or 10% of your conversation in that direction, you'll probably lose them.
Right.
But that's the frame that we were talking about here. We're looking at that kind of like a quick connection.
So finally, the perceiver part.
Right.
Which I think is... in my opinion, is it's hard for me to say this ever, but in my opinion, out of the four types, this is probably the one that's easiest to spot, generally speaking. Well, extrovert introvert's pretty simple to spot, right? But right. I mean, but actually, geez, how am I going to explain this? But what I really mean is that I think this actually sets people apart more than anything else. Is it an equal split for this?
Almost an equal split in the general population. There's slightly more judgers in the U.S. than perceivers, but it's like 52 or 3% to right. like 47 or 80. Exactly.
That's the other side of that. So perceivers are basically constantly making decisions in their heads for things ahead of time.
Perceivers are constantly adapting themselves to their environment and their surroundings. Judgers don't adapt to the environment so much. They prefer to adapt their environment to them. Judgers prefer to kind of like plan things out in advance and to know what they're going to be doing ahead of time, and they don't really like deviating from those plans. Perceivers, on the other hand, don't like to plan too much. They prefer to kind of go with the flow, see what happens, and improvise their way out of situations if things go bad.
And this is one of the best things about a perceiver, especially meeting a perceiver, a girl at a bar or something if you're out, is that you don't have to handle logistics. You can literally just give some kind of plausible deniability, like, let's go over here, or yeah. I have my cat does backflips, come check her out.
Right.
And she'll be like, okay, and she'll figure it out when she gets there. She doesn't really need a... hey, look, where's your car? Did your car park over here? Blah, blah, blah. You don't need to handle logistics. None of that stuff, right?
Yeah, if you're interacting with a judger, then you can kind of be the guy that's providing an experience outside her normal framework. But you kind of have to do a lot of hand-holding. You have to kind of like be the one leading the way the entire time. Whereas with perceivers, they're more kind of open to going with the flow.
And like they won't resist much.
Exactly. They won't resist very much.
Yeah. And so, and I'm a perceiver as well. And so is Brad. Yep. Which is really difficult for either of us to get anything done. We'll get on a conversation on Skype about something we have to do. And then 15 minutes later, we're talking yeah. about like something we saw on the internet, or it's Louis C.K. yeah. or something.
Right. Exactly. So, how to observe this? Again, perceivers are going to be focusing on just kind of like going with the flow and seeing what happens. They're going to probably clothing. It might be the easiest way to tell the difference here.
Reactions is probably one of the easiest way to really tell.
Yeah, reactions actually.
If you do something out of the ordinary, a judger will give you a different like not a scowling.
They'll almost freeze because they're trying to figure out what's happening here.
Yeah, they're you may see a little bit of a furrowed brow, like they're confused.
Right.
Perceivers are just like, woo, cool, right. Now we're doing this thing, right? No big deal. And it's not a big deal at all for perceivers, typically speaking, right? So when you start start to put all these together. Brad, did you say something?
I'm very fascinated by the fact that you said clothing.
Yeah, so just in broad strokes, judgers tend to be more kind of like, for starters, a bit more traditional, a bit more like everything has to be in place. They are focused on the details. And
it takes them forever to get ready.
It can take them forever to get ready, but they're like just trying to make sure everything is right. Everything's the way it's supposed to be. Everything's tucked in. Looking kind of sharp. Perceivers tend to dress a bit more for comfort And they can also kind of dress to impress. It's not about the details being perfect so much as it is having a like flair. So they're going to be a bit louder. They're in dress. They're going to be a bit kind of more sometimes rumpled or not as like not as perfect looking. And I'm using that in
thanks,
kind of
man.
A general sense. Yeah.
So a lot more like, let's say bohemian, like, style.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, exactly.
Unless it's, like, perfectly in place bohemian, which is, right?
Which is clever.
Yeah.
I mean, especially here in Venice, there's sort of, like, an upper-class bohemian, you know, where they're, like, upper-class people who want to be bohemian, so...
You mean yuppies?
Yeah, sure, yuppies. I don't know
the
exactly what the
look,
word is.
Yeah.
I've observed that there's certain some people who want to be bohemian and they go at it from sort of the top down instead of the bottom up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. It's like saying, what color hat should I wear to get me laid? Instead of going, you know, what should I be doing to attract women with my body? Or like, how should I go about it? It's like, it's more like getting the broad strokes there and going, okay, I'm just going to mimic this and doing it perfectly. For example, if it was like a, if there was a backwards hat thing,
right,
then a judge would probably be more likely to wear a hat perfectly backwards, and a perceiver would probably be more likely to wear something that's like a little bit, maybe a little bit turned or just not really thinking about it much, right? Just kind of thrown on, not a big deal. Especially if someone's analytical like I am. It's like I'm a function over fashion kind of guy.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
I want something to function more than anything. I don't care really about fashion much. The only reason why I care about fashion is because I'll make Kelsey look like an asshole.
Right.
If I don't dress a little bit like a man, at least. Okay, so we got clothing. Something a little bit more like, you know, it's hard to use words here because they're all like literal descriptions. Like you can't say loose because it's not loose clothing. It's more like a relaxed, like when they imagine them
a
getting
more relaxed
ready.
Look, that's a good way to put it too.
Yeah, like, I mean, imagine them getting ready. Right? If it looks like they just said, this is good and this is good and this is good. I'm ready to go.
Right.
It's probably a perceiver. And that's what you're really looking for. If someone's more like, this is good, but it doesn't go with my eye makeup, right? This kind of girl, she's got things matching throughout everything, and it's just perfect in every way. Those are the kind of girls that you can comment on that fact, right? I just can't believe that you actually took the time to match your shoes to your eyeshadow. Like,
right.
That kind of thing, they'll be like, oh my God, wow, you noticed, because no one really notices that stuff, you know? But a perceiver, if you said that to them, traditionally speaking, like this is generally speaking, you said that to a perceiver, you know, it's more like if you say that, they may be like, oh yeah, I didn't even think about it. Right. You don't get anywhere with them doing that. So
right.
A lot of guys will have one tactic that they try to sweep every woman with, right? Like, compliment her shoes, then ask her about her life, and then tell her to come back to check out your record collection. Like that's
slow down. I'm taking notes.
You know, and that's usually their like 1-2-3 punch, whatever.
Right.
But because that doesn't work on everyone, they get very hit or miss, and they're usually really dogmatic about it because without that they have chaos.
Yeah, well, that's a more of a judger approach as well.
Right.
It's coming up with a plan and sticking to that plan as opposed to adapting to the environment.
Exactly. Okay, so we've got clothes, that kind of thing,
yep.
And then we're looking at something less emotional. Typically speaking,
right?
How do you tell that?
It's usually fairly obvious. Feelers are going to use emotional language. They're going to have more emotion in their voice tone. They're going to be more interested in kind of connecting on a human level, as opposed to they're going to focus on the connection and the emotion present in the interaction as opposed to the information. Thinkers tend to focus more on information and data.
Right. And so in this case, like seeing someone who's focused on data and talking to them will be a lot easier for you.
Especially if you are a thinker.
Especially if you're a thinker. And a lot of guys communicate in data.
Right. Yeah, thinker-feeler does have a gender split. Roughly 60% of men are thinkers and roughly 60% of women are feelers.
So So yeah, so I think that probably for most guys who are going to be on this call, thinking about this, especially guys who come to me, you know,
right.
many of them aren't feelers. They're not, you know, they're not like coming to this searching for a system to attract women.
Right.
Usually, because that would be a little bit, you know, outside of their reality in a lot of ways. Brad is obviously there are plenty of exceptions to this. Brad is one of those exceptions, and I have
definitely
I have a very large split. You know, it's not like I have mostly thinkers and like that. But the most of the guys that I talk to that. If you're a thinker, I think you're going to go about this in a different way than you would if you're a feeler. If you're a feeler and you want to recognize another feeler, I think the best way to do it would be to use a lot softer touch and watch the way they touch people. This is very important. Okay. Thinkers will typically touch as a form of well, probably more likely to touch as a form of how am I going to explain this?
Punctuation.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Like it's a function.
Yeah.
Right. And then feelers are would be a lot more likely to touch as a form of expression.
Absolutely.
Right. So girls who are like, oh, my God, and they touch and they hug and that kind of thing, right? They're really feelery are probably feelers, right?
Right.
So the girls that you're probably looking at here are not going to be hugging and touching everybody, right? If you see a girl who's around like hugging and touching people a lot, it's very likely she's less of a thinker unless she's she's strategic, right?
Right. ESTPs or anyone that's an accuracy preference person actually usually kind of think that behavior, you know, touchy-feely, let's all hug, is kind of moronic. They usually kind of want to roll their eyes at that, whether or not they actually do.
Right. So coming at a girl, so you can imagine that coming at a girl like this from a place of like being super logical and she's really emotional, if you see that and she's like really sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And you keep going at it like, you know, very, very straightforward, logical, like,
right.
And you're trying to like make stuff happen. Like you're really almost like utilitarian. Like you want to get the job done in the end and move on. You're going to turn them off big time. But again, right. They're not going to be more likely to hook up with you without thinking about it anyway. Right. Typically speaking.
Not as much.
So.
Yeah.
So that's the feeler part. So now you know to look for someone who's got, let's say, who's not necessarily touching as a form of expression, right? Like touching people and being physical with people as a form of expression. More like when they do touch, it's like, hey, handshake, pat on the shoulder, arm around, you know, their neck kind of thing for a second. Like buddy-buddy touch, you know?
Yeah, the shoulder punch, so to speak.
Yeah. So you see a girl with a... you know, relaxed clothing. Like she dressed like, looks like she kind of just threw something on. It looks good. You know, she probably checked herself to make sure it looked good, but she's not thinking about it too much. And she's that kind of like friendly personality, right? Like
right.
Not so much sensitive and seductive sort of thing. So we got both of those personality types. And then of course the intuitive sensor is going to be more likely because it's 75% of the time. Don't even try to figure that out because it's really freaking hard.
It can be, yeah.
And then extroverted. Was the last one, and if you hear sort of fluid speaking patterns, and they're like taking the floor a lot, and they're expressive with their hands often, and they're really good looking and awesome and smart, they're probably extroverted. No, I'm just kidding.
Right.
So that's what you're looking for, right? This one specific kind of girl. This girl that is. No, of course there are others that are close to this.
Right. This is going to be the highest likelihood, though.
Right.
That they'll be open to something like that.
So look for those qualities and. When you do see that, you know that you said ESTPs are more likely to be very positively responsive to boldness.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you see a girl like this, you walk up, you know, you'd think, and this is a natural thought process, so don't feel weird if you think this, I don't feel bad, but you think that if you saw a girl who's feelery and touchy, that she would appreciate you being bold, right? So you'd walk up to her and you'd be like, I'd like to sleep with you, right? Or I think you're hot, that kind of thing. You would assume that would be the case. That's not always the case, of course.
Right.
But it's less likely to actually be the case. Like they're going to want something that is more substantial than just someone plowing over them, you know?
Right. The ESTP types, they prize boldness in themselves. And if you don't have it, then they just don't respect you a whole lot. So that's kind of, it's kind of a barrier to entry. It's like a threshold. And if you can, you know, show that you've got some balls, then you'll have their respect and, therefore attention.
And also since they really, since they really appreciate that sort of boldness in other people and themselves, you can walk up and say things like, you know, most women would probably not answer this question, but on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely would you be to say that I was sexy? Right? Because then they get an opportunity to be bold and they get an opportunity to say this to you, right? They may not say 10, right? They may joke around with you a little bit and mess with you a little bit, right? Not be so like open to you saying that, but they'll appreciate the opportunity to be bold.
Right. That, and they just love cutting through what they consider to be kind of social bullshit. So, don't focus on small talk. Don't try to be too nice, because they don't care, and they tend to it's actually kind of a turnoff.
Yeah, this is the kind of girl that you might want to say something like, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
Right? And she might be like, okay, let's go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
more likely to say that. We got a question from Brett Hoppenwasser. I'm going to go ahead and unmute you here, Brett. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Brett, how's it going?
Pretty well, Cameron.
Cool.
Josh.
And Brad. And,
my question was back when you guys were talking about the difference between intuitive and sensory.
Uh-huh.
When you guys were having that discussion, and I was just going to relate it to, like, from what I've learned so far, like, I had to go into my boss's office and tell him that I needed to quit my position and find something else to do, because I'm no longer going to be able to physically meet the demands of my job.
Uh-huh.
And before I knew this information, I hated talking to him. He just had this really just weird personality to me, and I didn't like being around it.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I know he's a sensor and I'm an intuitive, so I understand why he does things. He's also a thinker, too. So.
And you're a feeler.
I'm a feeler and I'm intuitive. So It was really odd knowing seeing that difference when I had to walk in there and I knew exactly how he was going to respond to what I was telling him. So I was prepared for that.
Right.
From learning this.
How did he take it?
He wasn't happy because he was thinking. While he was thinking about all the investment and the training that he's putting through for me, the facts that he knows someone that had a similar injury that I've had and what they went through, that's what he was basing his information on and relying on that when I was relying on how I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of on the fact that he was thinking about of all the training and stuff.
Right.
And so learning this stuff helped me go in there and be prepared for that ahead of time.
Right.
So you knew what kind of objections you were going to get and have an idea of how to respond to them and just generally know what to expect.
Absolutely.
So here's a question. You're an INFJ, right?
Yeah, I should mention real quick, Brett has been participating in the 6-month course that I mentioned teach. So he's been for the last 5 weeks or so.
Yeah, I was about to say, you learned all that shit from me, Brett? Wow.
we've just gotten going, but been very glad to have him.
Is he an INFJ?
Yeah, I haven't profiled Brett personally, but yeah, that's...
Is that what you got, Brett?
That's what he got.
From the last time he was on your call... We came to that conclusion.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's I forget every time because I have a terrible memory, but which is another quality of an ENTP. yeah, so that would be my guess too. And it's interesting to hear, you know, the introvertedness in your voice and stuff like that. It's really interesting to hear knowing that now and giving I give people a lot more time to talk than I used to. To respond back.
Yeah.
So, thanks, Brett. Is that it, or you got more?
Oh, no, that's it.
Perfect. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate you sharing that, Brett.
Thanks for sharing, and good to talk to you again.
Yeah.
All right. All right, guys, if you have any more questions, go ahead and type them in if you're online, or press star 2 if you're on the phone. Phil asked, his question was Al Gore, question mark? I guess that was earlier when I said that people like Al Gore. And now I'm not saying that Al Gore is the most influential person in the universe, but I am saying that he spoke at TED. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, he actually used that venue to test out the slideshow that eventually became an Inconvenient Truth. That's where he delivered it for the first time.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh, I didn't know that. I do know that I've been on his TV show. TV station, rather.
Gotcha.
Current TV.
So the question in there is, how likely is a sensation person to date a memory person? Actually, that's incredibly common.
Sensation and memory?
Yep.
Okay. So why is that common?
Well, basically the kind of big question that people have argued about is, do similar personalities attract, or do opposites attract? And
I know right now that Paula Abdul taught me that opposites attract.
Yeah, well, the answer is both, actually.
Well, she was wrong then. I'm going to tell her.
Yeah, you should tell her that. You generally tend to be most attracted to someone that is different than you are, and there's some polarity there, so it makes it interesting and exciting and fun, but not so different that you can't understand each other. So sensation is a sensory process, and memory is a sensory process, but they're different. They're similar enough to where they get each other, but they're different enough that they find each other interesting and exciting. So yeah, it's a really common pairing.
I think that intuitives also feel a lot more at home and comfortable being isolated from the rest of the world when they're dating each other.
Yeah, definitely.
Than they are when they're dating a sensor. They can kind of nest egg together. Sensors, I kind of feel, are the same way when they date each other. But I don't really know much about that, really, actually, because so the sensors that I do know, they are a lot more social in their relationship than the intuitives that I know.
Yeah,
dating each other.
That's often the case. One thing I will say, the most common question I get asked is, who should I date? What type should I date?
And you always answer INTJ.
Right. You should always, all of you, so long as you're attractive and female, should date me.
Right.
And the truth is that you can have a really successful, happy relationship. Like, any type combination can work, theoretically. So I generally won't give a person an ideal type. There's some things that work a lot better than others. One thing, though, I do recommend is that sensors tend to have a better time with other sensors, and intuitives tend to have a better relationship with other intuitives. That's not 100% true in every case across the board. Just in general, that usually works out better.
Yeah, if you had a person that you could look at and you could say, all right, I get to put any personality type on this person, and they will have that personality type, and they'll look like this, but they'll have that personality type.
Mm-hmm.
Certain ones will focus your relationship a lot more on growth. The more, not just intuitive versus sensor, but if you are dating someone who's very similar to you in personality type and you're an intuitive, then there can be a problem.
It can be, yeah.
And the reason why that there can be a problem is because they can think too much like you, and you won't grow, because intuitives have had this process ingrained in them that they needed to improve, because we thought that we were wrong. Most of us think that we're wrong when we're younger. So we have this sort of self, self-help kind of tendency.
Yeah, well, also just in kind of the intuitive mindset, the way those thinking processes work is more geared towards innovation. Since they're not focused on their senses, they're not really focused on the here and now, they're instead kind of focused on how things could be or how they will be later. So just that by the very nature, they tend to be more focused on improving things.
Right, so I think that really it comes down to your preference. Would you prefer to have an easy relationship, or would you prefer to have a growth-based relationship? Most people... relationships end because they base their relationships on comfort. That's why their relationships eventually end, because what happens in that situation is that the two of you begin to become stagnant or caught up in really petty bullshit because it's the only drama you have, right?
Yeah, if you end up in a long-term relationship with someone that is too close to your own type, it can feel good, especially at first, because you are totally on the same page and you get each other and you like the same things and so on, but you don't have that impetus to kind of push you to grow, and you're doubling up on your strengths, but you're also doubling up on your weaknesses. You both have the same blind spots.
Right. And neither of you will see things coming like an affair.
Yeah.
You know, that can happen often. So, so if we look now at sensors, dating sensors, or, you know, being in relationships with sensors, this is a generalization. I think that being a lot closer in personality type is a lot more beneficial to a sensor, meaning that if you're an ISTP, you may tend to have a better relationship with an ESTP than you would with a, you know, ESFJ, right? Because sensors are a lot more used to feeling like they're a part of something because they're 75% of the world are sensors.
Right, yeah.
And the, and all of the structure of schooling, climbing the corporate ladder, most businesses are structured this way. It's all built around a sensor mentality.
Yeah, specifically, it's geared mostly for sensor judgers.
Right.
But yeah, it's more focused on sensors in general.
So that's a lot of stuff so far. We can go back into some questions here. I think we need to start wrapping up. So if you guys do have any questions, go ahead and ping them in the questions box if you're listening on a webcast there online. And if you are listening via phone, press star 2 immediately if you have a question because we're going to be wrapping this up now. So we had a question before before the webinar started from a guy named Taz. And it says, I often find uncomfortable silences awkward. Okay, well, if it's an uncomfortable silence, I can imagine that it would be awkward every time, but that's okay. So I would like your advice on what it is, what is the best topics, okay, what are the best topics to talk with women whom he sort of cold approaches, meaning he walk up out of nowhere, and if he gets their attention and there's attraction. Let's see. And then this next part is just a run-on sentence. So, yeah, I'm afraid knowing what to talk about, which also create a connection. Okay, so I think that the question here really is, what do I say? What should be a topic of conversation whenever I walk up to a woman that I don't know? And what should be, what's the best connection conversation? Well, it depends on what time it is, really. If it's daytime, it's completely different than it is at nighttime. And the reason why is because we have different associations with daylight. We feel like we can't hide, so we don't try to as much. At nighttime, we think we can hide, and therefore we try to more often. So if you're approaching a woman that you don't know during the daytime, just sort of out of nowhere, then you're going to be much more have much better chance of things going on well in an attraction way if you focus a lot more on being direct. Because they feel like they can't hide, and you're walking straight up, and so they don't have as many barriers. So you can now jump straight into being like, you're really gorgeous, I want to talk to you, and then be a little bit playful. It really doesn't matter what you say, something like, so are you here like waiting on a blind date or something? Like that's all you need to start with, and then just start joking around about them waiting for a blind date and be like, if you were, I was going to pretend like I was your blind date and we could just go on a date and like I could show up and you wouldn't be here and you'd think that you got stood up, but that's okay, you know? And then if it's nighttime, you may focus a lot more on, you know, spending some time to sort of get past her barriers because she's going to have some that are up. So in that case, you may banter a lot more. You may drive by, meaning walk by, say something, then keep going, and then come back later. You may do a lot of these things to sort of build the attraction. There's a lot more playfulness in causing that. When you get into a connection, just if you want to just get the general rule for connection, just like the 1-2 punch, you want to get something from her, like hear her talk about something that would be like maybe ask her what she did before she got to where you are, like what'd you do before you came to this bar today, whatever. And then you want to take something that she says and relate it to something that happened to you when you were a kid. That's the easiest way to build rapport. You don't have to think about anything else. Just do that, then you're done, right? Got another question. Actually, it's not even a question. This is just talking about Asian women. I guess this will be really helpful. Maybe I'll bring it up. So Igor says, so I think this might be interesting to anybody who's aiming at Asian girls. He said he just discovered this week that there's actually a cultural sort of phenomenon for Asian women where they don't show that they like somebody even if they're really, really interested in the guy, right? They don't look like they like them. They don't talk to them, stuff like that. He said it's called sudere. That's what it's called. That's what they call it, I guess. So don't think that if they don't show interest, if you're talking to an Asian girl, if she doesn't show interest, in her or in you that she's not attracted to you. Typically in like Japan or wherever, he's writing from Japan. If they don't show interest there, guys typically come running after them, but that backfires in the U.S. and other Western civilizations. So that's a good little note there. Phil, another question here. If I'm being playful and gamey, and she says, why can't you be authentic and be real? Is this an ESTP? I don't know what an OSTP is, but that sounds cool.
probably a typo because the O and the I key are next to each other on the keyboard.
It could be a PSTP though, because that's next to it as well.
Yeah,
or a zero STP. So, so that would mean I would say neither.
Yeah. You're probably dealing with a feeler perceiver, an FP. They're the ones that use the process that we called authenticity. And for them, anything that smells fake or phony is, for starters, they see it a mile away and complete turn off. This is, again, a strength for Brad, so he could probably talk about that. Brad, how obvious is it to you if someone's being fake?
Very. It's made me really sort of naturally good at having that hunch, you know, just like looking at body language and going, something's off, you know?
Right.
Definitely. I definitely have an immediate feeling as to whether someone's being real or not. Like, it was really hard for me. Something I had to sort of teach myself was to appreciate, for example, salesmanship, you know?
Right.
Because when I first started encountering salespeople at a younger age, I was just like, you lied to me, you know, like you weren't really my friend. Like I felt like, like if I had a good interaction with the salesperson and I found out that they like made a commission or whatever, I was like betrayed. Right. You know?
That's like a terrible thing for, intuitive feelers too.
Yeah.
Because now you feel isolated even more, you know?
Right. Yeah. Cause salespeople are all over, right? Like almost right. Every store has somebody who's in a sales position. And so something I really had to do, which helped me a lot in just sort of understanding and being cool with people, was accepting that, there's something respectable in that, you know, like there's something respectable in being good at what you do, you know? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
So how would you, have responded to that question? Someone saying, you know, be real, you're just being fake or something. I can't remember exactly how it was worded, but what advice would you give?
Just be real. Why can't you be real?
What advice would I give to
someone who gets that Phil? Reaction?
Yeah.
I would say to share something that would sort of make you uncomfortable typically.
You know, what's funny is I would actually, Brad, if I could like jump in real quick and then let you finish.
Sure.
Is that okay? My immediate thought on this actually is to call yourself out. You know, because imagine you're talking to someone, Brad, and and you're like, you know what, just be real, and they're like, you know, I'm sorry, I just kind of get in this mode of talking like bullshitting around people that I don't know because that's just what I've learned how to do. But it's really nice to kind of let that go. Would you be more? Would you respect them more after they did that?
Absolutely. Yeah, so definitely.
That would be really powerful.
Yeah, you know? I think that'd be good.
Because here's what I'm thinking, Brad. Imagine that you're talking to me and you go, just be real, right? So I'm like bullshitting and you go, just be real, Josh. And I was like, when I was a kid. you know what I mean? I jump right into a story. You might be like, well, now he's trying to manipulate me with a story, right?
Yeah.
I think that it's a little bit more complex than that. I think that backing out actually might be a really smart thing to do. That's called a statement of what's so, right? And that is like a statement of what is so. And that is where you basically say, here's the absolute truth. The truth is that I don't really know what to say. So I just kind of start talking and bullshitting. And so it's kind of relieving to hear somebody tell me that because I feel like I don't have to try anymore.
Yeah, maybe both of those things in succession would be...
one right after the other, exactly.
Yeah, it's like...
Once you gain the trust of having called yourself out, then you could...
Then there's an opening for you to share something personal.
Exactly.
Absolutely, and that would be really, really good. That would, and I can see that being extremely effective too. In fact, I've used that before. I know because I can remember times now in which I've done that. You know, I have a really I have a really powerful ability to think on the fly like that and just go, okay, well, what do I need to do here? I'm going to do it right now. Done. Right. I just kind of finish it and it works. Not always.
I've actually met Phil as well. So I know that he has an extremely internal frame. So I can understand sort of his frustration with this kind of, you know, question that he's getting.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because it's hard to get feedback whenever you have an internal frame. Approach isn't so difficult, but getting feedback from women, their body language and responding to them and reacting to them can be really difficult. So yeah, definitely not one of the more popular questions we get, but a very, very good one. So thanks for asking that. So he said that I told her that, that if she would answer my gamey question, I would tell her a lot about her. So basically you just said, no, I'm not telling you about me. Instead, play this game so I can tell you about you, so you can be more vulnerable. Yeah, so that would backfire, in my opinion, typically.
Probably.
Yeah. Okay, so finally, and this is the last question here from Jonathan. He says, when do you delve into negative rapport topics in general? Meaning something that's a negative concept, negative conversation. When do you actually begin to talk about that? Because you don't entertain that in the beginning when you first meet a girl. You don't entertain negative rapport topics at all, because then she'll begin to dump all her problems on you. And then when and how do you help your partner grow in terms of mutual reinforcement? Meaning, when and how do you help your girlfriend, when she becomes your girlfriend, help her sort of improve herself? And in mutual reinforcement, this part is to like teach you something so that you can teach her something and you guys have mutual value. The first one is, when do you delve into negative rapport topics? And the answer is whenever you have 3 or 4 powerful, connected, deep, positive rapport topics. When you have stuff that's positive and there's an overwhelming amount of it, then you can go into one negative. I'd say it's probably 4 to 1, really. You know, if you have 4 good, positive rapport topics, you're allowed to go into one. But another thing you may do would be, you know, if she forces you into a negative rapport topic early, like, oh, my grandmother died yesterday and I'm really upset, you can't go, well, that sucks, but what else is going on in your life? You know, like, that's not going to work. You have to really be like, oh, I'm really sorry. And were you close to her? I'm really sorry about that. And, you know, to your grandmother, let's cheers to your grandmother. And, you know, she's resting in peace right now. You know, she's here with us and here in your heart. You know, like, you get in that sort of like deep, but it was negative rapport, but you're not trying to go like, oh, yeah, my grandmother died too. You want to fuck? Apparently that would work with Cameron.
I was just thinking, you know, that probably would almost never work, but if it did.
You better record that because, you know, you'd be a genius.
Yeah.
So I would say that there's that, you know, the negative rapport topic thing. Now, when it comes to the helping your partner grow, the when and the how in this are very, very different, very long answers. So I'll give very brief versions of both of these. When do you do it? You want to do it as soon as your honeymoon phase is over in your relationship. Typically after 6 months. 4 months usually, actually. If you're really, really in love, you know, it's like crazy. 6 months is about normal. If you're not so much, then usually around 4 months. If you're just like having a good time and it feels good and comfortable, then about 4 months. You want to start drawing the stuff out of them. And the way that you do that, the easiest way to do it is to find something they know a lot about and actually have them teach you a little bit about it. And you have to be genuinely interested, Jonathan. You can't, like, just go, oh, tell me about knitting. And as she starts talking, then your eyes glaze over, right? Like, I just want to know how to do one little thing. Ask her to teach you how to do one tiny thing, and she'll feel like she's given you a gift. This is important, because if you don't do this throughout your relationship, she'll begin to feel like you are too good for her. And if that happens, a lot of guys will be like, yeah, that'd be amazing. But the truth is that that happens. She starts to self-sabotage, and you are done. So keep that in mind. Guys, that's all we have time for today. I meant to cover a few more things, particularly spring break stuff.
Woo!
Can you say woo? Then you're good. No. we got the notes for next time, and hopefully we can get in that next call here, or very soon at the very least. So thank you guys very much for being here, Brad. Thanks for doing most of the talking. No, I'm sorry.
As always,
I kind of ran off with it there. I was like, Brad, I want you to talk more in this one. Then I just plowed over him. you know, steamrolled over.
That never happens with extroverts and introverts, by the way.
It does sometimes.
I'm just kidding.
I don't know what you guys are talking about, but I wasn't listening anyway. So, so anyway, thanks guys very much. Next week, Brad will be at the reins for sure, and we will be continuing conversation here. So be there. It's going to be the exact date is the 23rd. So mark that down in your calendars. 23rd, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. And I don't know, there are a lot of other time zones, and I don't have time to go into all the times and all the different time zones. So look that shit up. So same time, at least for you. And I hope you got a lot out of this. I'm really looking forward to helping you guys get into the, really dive into the next topic of conversation, which if we have time, hopefully we will, is going to be energy level whenever you talk to a girl. So really excited about that. And we may have another special guest on next week that we will announce, probably on the call, most likely. So be there. And learn as much as you can, and I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks again. Thanks, Brad. And thanks to Cameron for being here for this and really sharing all the massive amounts of knowledge that you have. That was really insightful.
My pleasure.
Awesome. Take care, guys. Talk to you soon.
Cheers.